Welcome to Real Talk, real estate discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers to the industry. You can find this show at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 12 of Real Talk. I try and bring you a cross-section of guests across all asset classes and throughout the capital stack. And on today's episode, we have the unbelievable fortune to have Stan Eisman, the chairman and CEO of American Realty Advisors. Stan oversees a $14 billion fund that both buys real estate directly and providing JV capital to owner operators and sponsors. Our conversation touched a myriad of topics from his open-ended fund and the current state of redemptions from some of his investors, the denominator effect, monetary and fiscal policy, the interplay between global markets and local issues that affect real estate. It was an extremely interesting conversation, and you'll see why Stan is known as one of the smartest people in the real estate business. He comes off like he's a professor, and that's because he is also a professor at USC. I know you'll enjoy my conversation with Stan.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Real Talk. Today, we have a special guest. We are honored to have Stan Eisman, chairman and CEO of American Realty Advisors. Stan, thank you so much for joining the show.
Andrew, I've been looking forward to this for a very long time because I wasn't invited on your first broadcast, and I figured that eventually I'd be able to get here. So thank you.
Well, we're taping this in early January, so I promise this will be the highlight of 2023 to date. I'm not going to say it's the highlight of 2023 at the time the year ends, but at least as of today.
It's the only one in 2023.
So, Stan, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about American Realty Advisors?
Okay, well, we are a traditional investment manager. All of our clients are domestic and foreign pension plans. They're all institutions, and they are investing in real estate because they are trying to diversify their total portfolio. And they look at real estate as a low volatility diversifier within the fund context. So what we do is we have two open-end funds, a value fund and a core fund. The core fund is what we would call our income fund. And the value fund is an income and appreciation fund. I would call our value fund a low risk fund. It is not as high risk as an opportunity fund is, but we do take some level of risk within the real estate universe. Within the open-end fund context, and it's important to understand where we're coming from as a firm, is that every one of our investors have the ability to be able to withdraw their money every quarter in order to be able to meet their needs should they ever want to get their money out, which is something we'll probably be talking about later on in this conversation. We have 585 investors around the globe that have invested with us, and we right now have $13.2 billion under management, all invested domestically within the United States itself, in primarily the four product types: office, retail, industrial, and multifamily, and some specialty with, we do storage, we do data centers, we do data center storage. We're doing life science as well. We do a lot of development in our value fund, and we can talk about that. So it's a broadly diversified portfolio within each of the funds, geographically diversified within the core fund because it's trying to meet the benchmark. And it's important, Andrew, that we talk about this because we are a relative return investor, not an absolute return investor. And that's important. A relative return investor is trying to beat the benchmark. So if you think about this in your mutual fund, you're trying to beat the S&P or the Dow or the NASDAQ. What we are trying to do is we are trying to beat the what is called the open-end fund index, which is the Odyssey index for our core fund. And then for our value fund, exceed that by 200 basis points or 300 basis points. So the strategies are driven by the needs of our investors.
So there's a lot to unpack here. I just want to cover at least first the basics. So where you guys sit, are all of your deals, when you're investing in real estate, is it through a joint venture model where you are partnering up with an operator or sponsor, or do you guys buy real estate directly?
I would say the vast majority of our real estate, 75% of our real estate is direct, and 25% is through joint ventures or pref equity or mezz debt.
Mm-hmm. And does it does that 25% change based on whether it's the core fund or the value add fund?
Well, the value add fund is going to have more joint ventures than the core fund. The core fund, interestingly enough, if you're a member of the Odyssey Index, there's a limit on terms of the number of joint ventures you can really get into that is built into the Odyssey guidelines. So there's 28 funds that are members of the Odyssey Odyssey Index that make up that index, which is what most people primarily use as the benchmark within the real estate universe today. Because that represents the broad base. I would say that the Odyssey Index represents the broad base of institutional real estate in the United States.
Yeah. And when I've transacted with your company, it's been mostly through joint ventures where I've been representing an operator sponsor. I'm actually surprised to hear that only 25% of your business is through joint ventures, which means to me that you have built a vertically integrated shop where you are able to source, acquire, operate, rehab, sell, all through ARA.
Well, let me just differentiate one thing that what we don't do. We're not vertically integrated in the context that we have our own development arm, and we're not vertically integrated in the context that we have a leasing or property management company or services that we offer.
Sure.
Everything that we do is through third-party firms on the leasing side and on the property management side, and development is primarily done through joint ventures. We typically will not do that. Now, on rehabs and renovations, we will contract, obviously, with third-party GCs, but we are going to manage that internally ourselves.
But fundamentally, you guys, at least for 75% of your deals, you're sourcing them, you're working with the brokers directly,
yes,
and acquiring them, as opposed to other large, I'll call them Wall Street-based institutional real estate investment management companies who rely on partnering with strategic operators who find the deals, and then they partner with those operators and provide, you know, equity in terms of, you know, 90 to 95% of the common equity stack.
That would be, that's true. I think that the large number of what we would call PERI firms, the private equity real estate firms in the country, are closed in, and they are going to be working through joint venture partners. Some of them do their own work themselves, but most of them do not.
So at least in the institutional joint venture world, from where I sit, the market has, I don't want to say dried up. I should say that they have chosen to sit on the sidelines. So the deals that we have closed over the last 6 months, for the most part, have been either 1031 exchanges, all cash buyers, or syndication buyers through a friends and family raise. The deals that we typically transact with institutional joint venture partners, they just haven't been there. We thought that after the summer, they'd come back after Labor Day and transact in a typical fourth quarter fashion, which has always been the busiest quarter in our industry. It just didn't happen. We're now sitting here in January of 23, waiting for price discovery, waiting for the transactional volume to pick up. How has your experience been over the last 6 months?
Well, talking about unpacking a lot there, that is a lot to unpack. And let me try to, let me step back and not sound too professorial, which I do when I'm teaching it at USC. But the real issue here is you have to understand is that the investor base today is really dealing with something called the denominator effect and the asset allocation model that they have. So a large pension plan that, let's assume for the moment, has $100 million, is only going to put it in real estate approximately 5 to 10% of their total portfolio. If the stock market goes down by 20%, that means that they're overweighted real estate, and they're going to have to do something about that because they have a programmatic systems sure. within most pension plans to actually rebalance their total portfolio. And when they start thinking about rebalancing, they have to do one of two things. They either have to take money out of the out of real estate, which they can't. If they're in an open-end fund, they can do. In a closed-end fund, they can't, because that's permanent capital within that closed-end fund. So we have two dynamics here. One is the denominator effect driving decision-making that impacts people putting more money into funds. And then number two, we have valuations that are being readjusted given where the market is today. So as valuations are being readjusted, then what's happening is that our portfolio values are going down. So if real estate is being marked to market, because again, what I started off with by saying is that we're a relative return player, we're trying to benchmark ourselves against everybody else. What we're doing is that for all practical purposes, we have to adjust our marks on a quarterly basis through a third party. We don't even set those marks ourselves. And those marks are backward looking. And it's not like the public market. The public market reprices every nanosecond. The private market reprices on a quarterly basis, looking at transactions in the rearview mirror. So it's almost like driving down the street backwards and using your rearview mirror to get there, because you just don't know where values are going to be. But we do know that based upon spot prices, that the valuations are going down. And as that happens, that means that guys like us who are running funds are being very chary about what they're going to do, because we don't want to take political risk with regard to our investors in making bad decisions. And number two, we just don't even know how to price in today's marketplace. And I think that has been the roadmap over the last 6 months that all of us have been looking at, leaving aside, and we will get into, if you want to, we can get inside of the entire discussion about debt mark to market, as well as resets and rebalancing and caps that are going to impact a lot of investors in real estate over the next 6 to 12 months.
Well, I guess if I could ask a specific question, have you guys been transacting in over the last 6 months?
We have been selling to the extent that we can transact on the sell side, because we're raising capital, trying to be able to meet our redemption request as well as our cash needs going out over the next 2 to 3 years, because we've got a big development pipeline that we've got to fund, along with CapEx obligations that we have with each one of our properties. So you have to be able to manage around that. So we're selling. Are we sellers at the market? In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. Where our pricing has not been met, we're not going to sell. We're gonna hold it, because we believe that there was a period between, I was going to say, certainly in October, November, where there was a lot of uncertainty in where the 10-year was going to go, and people were pricing off of a 4-2 10-year treasury, which has really come in off of that. Sure. And I think that has impacted a lot of people saying, we don't really think that that's really the number, so we're not going to necessarily sell unless we have to. Now, the Blackstone transaction just occurred with regard to the University of California Regents, I think is a very dispositive conversation, because that tells you a lot about where the market may be, because Blackstone not being able to honor those redemptions forced them into making a deal with the University of California Regents, which I think is a great deal for the California Regents. Not sure where Blackstone is on that, but getting 11.25% pref return on that is a pretty lucrative return on a priority basis.
And so what does that tell you about, I guess, Blackstone's perspective on the market, or maybe your perspective on the market going forward? And I know you mentioned that the 10-year has come in. We're taping this, what is it, January 12th, and I think it finished what, around 3.4, 3.5, the 10-year treasury today. So it has come in quite a bit. And so what does that Blackstone deal sort of tell you?
Well, I think that the Blackstone deal, because they are the largest private equity real estate company in the world, and I think that their number, they are so visible. I mean, every day you pick up the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal, the fact that they couldn't meet those redemptions is pretty existential risk. I mean, that raises a lot. That raises concern on the retail side. I mean, most of their investors are retail investors, and I think that that was unique and it was idiosyncratic to them, not necessarily to every fund. We in the open-end fund universe, we have elected, all of us who are in the open-end fund universe have redemptions similar to Blackstone. What we have done is we have gated those redemptions. And what we're doing is we're paying them out slowly over the next 3 quarters or 4 quarters, because what we want to do is we do not want to be put in the position, as every other investor is saying the same thing. We don't want to be put in the position where we're going to be selling in a marketplace that we don't think is pricing effectively. So if you look at the number of transactions on the market today is significantly lower than it has been in the years past.
Sure.
Number one. And number two, transactions that are closing is significantly lower. And I think that creates a bid-ask spread and creates opportunities for those who need cash to be, and they're forced to sell. And it creates opportunity for those who have liquidity and want to go in and buy. But there has not been capitulation yet, in my mind, except at the margins. And that's a whole different conversation as well.
So with respect to, I mean, we could talk for hours, but with respect to the redemptions that your investors have requested, what is their plan in with that money? Is that they need to reallocate it because of the denominator effect?
Well, there's multiple reasons for redemptions. One is the rebalancing obligation they have that's triggered by programmatic guidelines in their asset allocation model. The Yep. other is to pay benefits. So, I mean, let's look at CalPERS being the mother of them all with, I think, $450 billion. They have to pay massive amount of money in benefit payments to their retirees. And if think about this, 6 months ago or a year ago at the beginning of the year, with treasuries at as low as they were, their income return was very low, and they were basically paying those with contributions and appreciation that was coming off of the stock market. With appreciation being negative in the stock market, and interest rates not where they are today, they were required then to get the reason they invest in real estate is because of the income that is being generated off of that, because that is generating the 3.5-4% cash return that is being distributed back to the investors. So our dividend distribution to our investors through our fund is 4%. So that pays a lot of benefit payments to these investors. So the need to fund benefits as well as the rebalancing obligations drives them to pull the money out. Where they're gonna put that money is probably gonna be in higher risk, higher octane investments, because they need to be able to generate some level of return. So that may be private equity, venture capital, hedge funds. It depends on where their asset allocation model tells them to go.
That could cause even more risk, though.
It does. And therein lies the problem. The problem is that people, most of us as investors, you and I individually, we use the word risk, but we don't necessarily know how to quantify what that risk is. You want high returns. I mean, I love it when people turn to me and say, well, I want a 12% return. I say, well, you got to take risk. Well, no, I don't want to invest if I have to take risk. And so you sit down and you look at what they're investing in, and somebody turns to them and says, well, you're going to get 12%, but it's not going to be risky, which we all know is not necessarily accurate.
Right. So if going back 12 months, January of 22, which at least in my business, probably the point in time where it was the busiest time in my career from January 21, maybe even a couple months before that, all the way to the early second quarter of 22. And now sitting 8 to 12 months later, just talking about how transactional volume has dried up considerably. I mean, would you ever have thought just 8 to 12 months ago that we would be in a set of circumstances, an economy and market that we're in today? It happened so quickly.
It happened quickly just principally because of the fact that the Fed made the wrong call on where inflation was. And this is a very nuanced conversation, but my view internally has been, and I still believe it, is that inflation is not transitory and it's very sticky. And as a result, I think we all believe, those of us who are more rational than others, believe that inflation is a much more insidious issue that's going to impact our country and the world rather than higher interest rate. Higher interest rates have personal impact, but inflation has dramatic impacts and it may have political and social consequences as well. So I think that leaving aside the political statement I just made, the reality is that the Fed sits down and realizes that when they made the call that it wasn't really transitory and it wasn't going away, then they had to do something very quickly and very hard. And I think that the seven increases they made over a very short period of time was absolutely necessary. Does the market believe, does the public believe, do you and I believe in the back of our minds that the Fed is really going to live up to what they said? Because the stock market the stock market speaks with a different language. They're looking at this and they're saying, we think the Fed is going to come back and save our butts again. And that to me is really a big issue.
When you say save our butts again, do you mean stopping the increase or even lowering rates by the end of the year?
We have been living in, I grew up in the, I graduated law school in 1973 and I lived through the late 70s and I was doing deals in 79 and 80 when I was a real estate lawyer at 13-14% interest rates. And I thought that we could make deals work at 13-14% interest rate. We have been living in a world since 1981 with the winds at our back, with declining interest rates that have gone down to, in European countries, down to negative interest rates. So we have been we have had incredible tailwinds behind us that have really been pushing hard assets. The Fed has basically said to us, we're going to give you this capital because we don't want to run the risk of a declining economy. And what that does is it forces us into taking more risk in hard asset investments coupled with stock market. So it's going to be a new world. It's going to be a new paradigm in terms of how we're going to have to rethink investing in real estate. I don't know if I'm answering your question specifically, but I may have missed the... We're meandering here on this one.
Well, I guess, how about looking forward instead of looking backwards? What will it take for there to be price discovery across the majority of the real estate market? Granted, every asset class stands on its own, every location stands on its own. But as we sit here, January, the volume of deals is probably, just a fraction of what it was 12 months ago. Not saying let's get back to January 21, but what will it take to get to a healthy level of volume of real estate transactions?
This is my opinion. It's called certainty and predictability and being able to know where interest rates really are going to be. Right now, we don't know what we don't know with regard to where the Fed is going to go and how we are going to price real estate debt or other debt. I mean, it makes no difference what the debt is. Once that hits a stability point where we have a little bit more certainty, then we will know, then people will start coming back into the market because then you can price effectively off of that. What I use in our investment committee is the reality that if I can go out and buy a 10-year treasury at 5%, my risk premium for real estate has to be at least 200 basis points over that.
Sure. I've got clients that use that exact line all the time.
Okay. So,
but it doesn't take into effect appreciation though.
Well, but all I'm doing is I'm looking at the IRR calculation here. And what I'm looking at is, I mean, I used to, our mantra in real estate for many years was we underwrote everything to a 9. It was only in the last 20 years that we started underwriting things to a 7, to a 6. And that's primarily because of the fact that we had such low interest rates that were driving this. The other factor that I think that impacted us over the last 3 years, 4 years, was the fact that rental rates have been going up in non-office properties, but industrial, multifamily, certainly, and in some level, grocery-anchored retail, have been going up at a fairly exponential rate. I mean, we had Odyssey in 2021 up 40% in industrial in terms of return. That is unsustainable, obviously. It just doesn't work that way. So I think certainty and predictability in terms of interest rates is going to give us a lot more visibility in terms of being able to price and then being able to buy and then to come out of the woodwork. Because I think the dry powder right now, I think the numbers that I saw the other day were like $270 billion sitting on the sideline waiting. And those funds can only sit down and not invest for a limited period of time. I mean, the investors are going to require them to come out and they're going to have to capitulate and invest in this marketplace.
Doesn't that tell you that there's so much money sitting on the sidelines that any recession will be shallow and that the pain and the blood on the streets that people are predicting won't really be there because there's just so much money that needs to be deployed, and that any analogy or comparison to the great financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 is just misplaced?
Well, only to the extent that there's not a complete wipeout of net worth, of household net worth, which is very high right now. I mean, we're at record numbers of household net worth. And I think that as long as that holds and people, A, the consumer continues to buy, B, there's no housing recession, which impacts the pricing of housing, C, that the real estate market doesn't diminish, and that D, the stock market doesn't collapse another 30%, I think we're going to be, it'll be relatively shallow. The exogenous risk that is out there, and I'm just going to throw this out for you to think about, is that I think that that China opening up this last week has the potential to create high inflation. It could be very highly inflationary, because what you're doing is you're uncorking 1.5 billion number of people that have not been buying, have not been spending, have not been traveling, and they're going to go out and start doing all of that, and that's going to drive up demand for goods and services. And the problem is that that's going to drive up the price of energy, and energy's already, even though it's going down, that's because people are, China has not been really spending right now, and there's a slowdown in the economy. The other exogenous factor we really don't know is what's going to happen with Ukraine in terms of food supply and commodity supplies, and whether that's going to be, whether if that continues on, that could drive up further the price of commodities. And we know that energy this winter could be driven up even higher. I don't know if you got your gas bill yet from Southern California Edison, but mine came in yesterday and they said it was going to go up 3 times as high as it was the month before. So there's going to be, there could be some pain there.
So when I'm listening to you and you're talking at such a high level when it comes to global economic, social, political issues driving your decisions, how much of a driver are those issues compared to, you know, the old fashioned location, location, location about real estate, the micro aspects of real estate, the neighborhoods, the renters, radius of population and wealth within a mile, 5 miles, 10 miles. How much weight do you put into local issues versus global issues?
Well, I think global issues drive the economy. So you look at it that way, local issues drive the real estate. And so from that standpoint, that everything is local. I mean, it all comes down to what is the risk that we can underwrite, and there's two risks. There's systematic risk, non-systematic risk. Systematic risk, which is the stuff that impacts like political risk, transportation risk, water risk, climate risk. These are all risks that you have to underwrite. Insurance risk. I mean, for example, if you're going to go buy multifamily in the Southeast, which we have a lot of, your insurance costs because of you're insuring around hurricanes and tornadoes, has gone up exponentially. And sure, that is going to impact your overall return. So we're looking at all of those dynamic drivers because they are going to ultimately drive whether the tenants are going to be able to pay the rent that are going to need to go in there. So it all comes down to the due diligence on that level. What I can't underwrite, very frankly, is I cannot underwrite tax risk and political risk. I can't underwrite the city of LA superimposing an eviction moratorium again, that is going to basically stop me from throwing out my tenants, because that's going to drive value and it's going to drive return. But what we're trying to do is underwrite those risks which we think are under our control. Property
or prior to this last election day in November, underwriting a transfer tax that would be, 4 or 5%.
Yes.
In the city of LA.
Right. And now you have to underwrite around that. And you have to now, this should be great business for you, because I'm already getting, we've got joint ventures up and down the state, where our joint venture partners are coming in on with these new fangled ideas of how to get around the transfer tax in San Francisco and in LA.
Sure.
So, but yes, those are the existential challenges that you can't figure out how to underwrite around. This gets into a broader discussion. We are invested in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Chicago and Boston. But let's take Chicago and Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, San Francisco. These are relatively progressive cities where we have had significant issues surrounding the portfolios just as a result of the political issues, social issues, policing issues, demand issues, and that's going to have a very big long-term impact on maintaining values in areas like that. And
so are you looking to go more into red states?
Well, therein lies, that's what you're driven to the opportunity that creates the lowest hurdle to be able to achieve return. But having said that, everybody else who's going to be listening to this has already done that. We're all going into Austin. We're all going into Charlotte. We're all going into Dallas and Houston. So the reality is that where the question really now is where's the opportunity in these cities that we're having difficulty with? We're in Portland. We have three office buildings in Portland, and it's tough. It is really tough.
So looking forward 12, 24 months ahead, are there particular asset classes that you think will fare better? Obviously, office is a four-letter word, but there's likely to be a lot of distressed opportunities to buy office on the cheap. You said you transact across all of the four major food groups, along with the alternative specialty asset classes. So where are you looking?
Well, right now our primary focus, I think everybody's primary focus, is on industrial. And this is where the big issue is that the overbuilding in industrial and the overbuilding in multifamily. In every one of the markets, if you look at the vacancy rates in every major market in the country, they've gone up by 100 to 150% in the last 9 months. Well, they're relatively low. It's not, we're talking about vacancy going from 5% to 10%, but we're talking about vacancy going from 3% to 5.5% to 6%. And it's going up, and the demand side is slowing down in terms of absorption other than industrial. Industrial seems to be a very strong market. And I think that in areas, let's just take California, which is, it's harder and harder to get entitlements. California is the new laws that create limitations on sensitive receptor sites for industrial locations, I think is very important for people to really understand. You can't build and get entitlements when you're near schools or hospitals or playgrounds or housing, and communities are becoming very resistant to having trucks drive up and down their streets.
Absolutely.
So So that's going to be a very big issue. And by the way, it's also happening in blue state, in red states too. I mean, it's the same thing is happening there.
Yeah, well, look, trucking terminal might as well have been a four-letter word when exploring with different communities last year of potential development, and they wanted nothing of the sort.
Right.
You know, in our remaining time, Stan, and you're so generous with your time, I would love me personally to hear, because I don't know the story, and for my audience to hear the story as an attorney, and most attorneys, and then maybe I shouldn't say most attorneys, but I think entrepreneurial attorneys are, always want to explore and to see, what it would be like to be on the business side, to be entrepreneurial, to be a principal, to be on the other side of that phone call. You alluded to that, the fact that you were an attorney. So tell us, how did you pivot from being a lawyer to then getting into the real estate world to now, you know, being chairman and CEO of ARA?
Well, you know, it's the answer is not going to be very sexy. It's purely by accident, and, you know, better be lucky than smart. But I believe, like you did, that I was probably as smart as my clients that I was doing legal work for, if not smarter. What I didn't realize was that once you switch over to the business side, there's a whole nother side to drafting a document that we did not get involved in as a law firm. That was just not part of the parlance that we actually evaluated. We weren't looking at the pro formas and underwriting. What actually happened is one of my clients asked me to come in and be the chief administrative officer of their company, which was a real estate syndication company. And I had the dubious distinction of joining on August 1, 1985, after practicing law for 12 years. And that was the day that Dan Rostenkowski announced the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which took away every bit of the syndication dollars that we were going to be putting out. And my job was to try and oversee and run this company that we had built up to syndicate billions of dollars every year. And by 1987, we had concluded that we were going to have to pivot into something else. And one of our wholesalers happened to be Smith Barney, that sold our syndications. And Smith Barney, for those of you who are old enough to remember, was a Wall Street brokerage house. And what we did is form a joint venture with them to go out and raise institutional capital. And lo and behold, the recession hit in 1990. It didn't work. And I left on my own with my secretary, and I formed American Realty Advisors and started to go out and knock on doors and raise capital. That was probably the most interesting experience I've ever had, because I've never actually sold anything in my life, and I had to go out and knock on doors and raise capital. And I got a lot more no's than I got yeses. And it really toughens you up, and it teaches you a great deal about what works and what doesn't work. And what we did is we sort of found a niche in terms of being able to raise capital that was a little bit different from some of the other people. And it just sort of took off. And so started off doing separate accounts, which was like $100 million separate account. Then we started doing funds. And now we're trying to develop new funds, which are closed end vehicles that are going to play off of what our strengths are as an organization.
And in 1990, were you going after institutions?
All institutions. I did not want to go after individual investors. I was doing a lot as a lawyer. I was doing a lot of legal work on putting together packages and syndication packages. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. So we would syndicate through the wholesalers like Shearson, Smith Barney, etc. And they were all tax shelter syndications going for the high net worth, or it actually wasn't even high net worth. It was the guys putting in $20-25 million. It's $1,000. Same guys you're putting into Blackstone's BREIT or the SREIT or the HREIT.
And so I talk to clients, especially clients that are, you know, maybe graduating from their friends and family syndications to then going to an institutional joint venture model to possibly a fund model. And one of the common themes of that discussion is how to crack into the institutional investor world, the pros and cons of that world, but it's very hard to crack into. And so your first entree into ARA, you bypassed the friends and family and went straight to the institutional world. Is it because you had those contacts from your legal?
I understood what the institutional universe was looking for. They are, I mean, if you step back a moment, institutions are really risk adverse. At the end of the day, they're dealing with pension money. They're a fiduciary to these beneficiaries. They need to fund those pension benefits. And if they don't, then they're, I mean, like CalPERS has to raise taxes to be able to pay those benefits. So compliance and systems and processes are critically important. And one of the things that I think is very hard for people who want to break into the business to appreciate is that the compliance side of the business is difficult. We're a 40 Act advisor. I'll give you an example. Every email that I send out has to be saved for 7 years. Every piece of paper that we send out has to be reviewed by somebody to make sure that it's not using words that are violative of the 40 Act standards. And it takes a lot of effort to do that. And most guys in real estate, gals in real estate, are at the end of the day, they're entrepreneurs. And they're not interested in the details of this type of a business. And you really have to be very disciplined to be able to do it. I'm not saying you can't do it. I mean, a lot of people have done it. It just takes a little bit more work to be able to put those systems and processes together to be able to do it effectively. And for people to believe that you really live it and breathe it. I mean, our culture of compliance here is very, very robust. Very, very robust. I mean, there's a culture of compliance that stems from me. Like, for example, you and I know a lot of people are running for office in the city of Los Angeles, and I can't give them money. I can't even make a donation, because if I give them a donation and then I go to the city of LA's pension plan and I raise capital, I can't collect a fee on it.
Well, that could be a good thing then. That's your answer to anybody who asks you for money.
Well, it is. It's a great way to call up anybody that says, sorry, I can't do it. The pay-to-play rules prohibit me.
Yeah, well, that's great. You have a minute or two left for lightning round questions. Sure. So quick answers to these questions. All right.
Andrew, anything.
If you weren't in the real estate business, what would you be doing right now?
Oh, gosh. I would probably be teaching. I would continue on.
Well, you're already a professor or a teacher at SC. That's great. Best advice someone has given you?
Best advice is don't take no for an answer and don't be afraid to fail.
I like that. I agree with that. At the end of this year, will you say ARA will be a net seller or a net buyer?
At the end of this year, 2023? Yeah. Probably a net seller based upon where we are today. Now, interestingly enough, I just wanted last year, 2022, was our largest fundraising year ever. We raised more money in 2022 than in the history of the entire company. It is remarkable during that period of time that we raised that type of capital. But right now, where we're concerned is that we have to meet the redemption. So we are going to be a net, probably more of a net seller than a net buyer. But that all depends on where the denominator is, because once the denominator turns, because we're outperforming the index, we may start getting a lot more money coming in down to us. In fact, shockingly, in December, we got a huge allocation of new money into our core fund, which is really odd. So it could be that we may be a buyer as well.
Interesting. Well, on that note, I'm going to leave it here. Stan, you've been such, I really appreciate all your time and the conversation that we had, I hope will be extremely informative, and illuminating to all of our listeners. I really appreciate you coming on to The Real Talk.
Well, thank you for including me, and I hope it works for the listeners.
Best of luck to 23 and beyond.
Thank you,
Stan.
Talk to you soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Take.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and sharing this show with others.